Good afternoon. Calling State Affairs Committee to order at 3:18 p.m. Today we have two presentations, really one under the banner of elections from the Municipality of Anchorage, looking back on their most recent municipal election conducted by vote by mail, as well as a presentation from the Division of Elections on a variety of subjects. And then we also have a hearing on HB 408, which I think it's worth noting is getting potentially parallel consideration in another committee of jurisdiction, which I'm sure Representative Ledoux can speak more to. Going in order, we've got Barbara Jones, the municipal clerk from Anchorage, to speak to the vote by mail election, followed by Josie, and then HB 408 in that order. And start with you, Ms. Jones. If you can put yourself on the record, and it doesn't seem as though we have a PowerPoint or presentation from you, but we do have a printout titled Certification of the April 3, 2018 Regular Municipal Election. And please go ahead and put yourself on the record and make your presentation.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I'm Barbara Jones. I'm the Anchorage Municipal Clerk and Election Administrator. And we just finished our first official vote-by-mail election for our regular municipal election on April 3rd. And would you like me just to mention a couple of the highlights that I discussed in the report?
Yes, please.
I think some of the really interesting things are that we mailed 194,000 ballot packages to registered voters in the municipality. And the final turnout, as noted in the report, was 79,295 ballots cast. I think that we did a great job on our outreach and education. I did not have any people call me to tell me that they didn't know the election was vote by mail. I had people call that were unhappy that the election was vote by mail, but everyone did know about the vote by mail election as far as our records showed. We had a number of drop boxes, 12 drop boxes, and 5 accessible vote centers for people throughout the city. The drop boxes were to use if you didn't want to use the post office. The accessible vote centers were for people who didn't want to vote the mailed ballot or didn't receive the mailed ballot. Then I think, interestingly, we did receive about 12,000 ballots from the accessible vote centers, but most of the ballots that we received were through the mail. We thought we'd get more through the drop boxes, but most of them came back through mail. And I think one of the things I'd really like to thank the state of Alaska for, we worked with the state on getting the data for the election, as well as making sure that we had signatures. And we ended up with only one ballot envelope that we rejected for lack of a reference signature. And that, in part, goes, a great deal of thanks and help from the state to make that happen, among other areas. And we've met with our workers, we've met with the stakeholders, we've met with an Assembly Ethics and Elections Committee. We're talking to them about what's next. We're meeting with the Assembly in a work session tomorrow, and we're meeting with the state in May. So we've got lots of plans going forward. We recognize some things that worked and some things that didn't work. And we're going to try and figure out what we want to do differently for next year as soon as possible. And that's about it for me.
Thank you. Could you speak to some of the things that worked, some of the things that didn't work, and some of the things that you're looking to do differently?
Sure. So I think the number one thing that worked, I would say, was our outreach and education campaign. We had there were some misunderstandings, but most voters understood the instructions about how to vote the ballot, put the ballot in the security envelope, and put the security envelope with the ballot into the return envelope. That seemed to work very well. We believe it was partly our PSAs, our media, and then the actual social media was really good. But we also did probably about 400, maybe 40 presentations to community councils and other groups. And I think that that was very, very effective. Another thing that I would say was very effective was our election center. If you haven't seen the election center, we would love to take anyone on a tour at any time. It is a big open warehouse, but because of the openness, it's very transparent, and it's exactly what we wanted the public to be able to see, that everything we're doing is out in the open. So those are two things that worked really well. A couple of things that people made comments on were that the drop boxes are white, and in April in Anchorage, there was snow, and it was hard to see the drop boxes. So they've asked us to do something a little bit different with the drop boxes next year. Another comment that we've got from some of our workers is we need a couple more computers. Right now, we have about 47 computers down there, but we need more. And it's very clear that we've moved from elections, which are really very clerical, to having technology do a lot of the work for us. And so we do need a couple of more computers. So those are two things that I think we did well and two things that we could improve on. And I think there was one more part to your question.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much for that. And before I add that last part, I want to note that our initial quorum for the meeting was Representatives Tuck, Ledoux, and Birch, as well as myself, Chair Christ-Tompkins, and then Representative Wohl joined us at 3:25. The last part of my question, which maybe dovetails with the areas that didn't go so well, is what you're looking to change or do differently in the future.
Well, I think some of the things that we have to look at and do differently in the future is this was a mayoral election, and typically the municipality has pretty good turnout in mayoral elections, and I think we need to make sure that we keep the momentum going in the assembly elections that are going to be coming up in the next 2 years. I think one of the other things that the election, as I mentioned, was very technologically based, and I think that we need to make sure that we have the skill set to manage that technology. So those are two things that we are looking at for next year.
Thank you very much, Ms. Jones. Any questions from the committee? Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mrs. Chair. Looks like that 194,507 ballot packages were sent out. I know that there is reports of a lot of duplicates. Is that excluding the duplicates or including the duplicates?
Well, you know, I think the duplicates issue was a little bit misleading. So let me see if I can explain that. There were 1,400 replacement ballots that were sent to voters who changed their name or their address with the State of Alaska Voter Registration Database between the time that we got our data, which I believe was on March 1st, and March 10th. So it was only 1,400 ballots. It was a very, very small number. And that does not include that number. There were probably over about 3,000 replacement and absentee ballot packages mailed, and that's probably not included in that number.
Okay, so if I make sure I understand correctly, so there was actually more than 194,000 that were packages that were mailed out due to the fact that there was another 3,000 that needed to be sent.
That is correct. So the 194, that was what was mailed on March 13th from the printer.
Okay. And then it looks like to me that, and I'm not sure if you said this or if I misheard, but I thought you said that the more ballots were casted, were delivered by mail, returned by mail, But if you add 31,000 that was done at the 12 secure ballot boxes plus the 12,000 that were done at the five accessible vote centers, that adds up to 43,000. So it looks like that there would be less than 50% were done by mail.
Representative Tuck, we don't include the drop boxes. We include that as a separate source. So what we're looking at, and I do have this in my report, I believe it's on page 3 and 4 of the report, 46% of the ballots were returned by the U.S. Post Office, 38% were in the secure drop boxes, and 14% were from the accessible vote centers. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Representative Ledoux.
What percentage did you say again were returned by the post office as undeliverable?
Well, I didn't say what percent. The number, so there's two numbers regarding undeliverables. First, the registered voters in Anchorage is about 218,000. So we only mailed to 194,000. Because there's about 22,000 voters in the voter registration database that have a condition code, and that's a state of Alaska condition code of undeliverable. In addition, after we mailed the 194,000, we got approximately 20 to 21,000 again returned undeliverable. So the total undeliverables is over 40,000.
Follow-up?
So I'm just trying to figure out, of the population of Anchorage, what percentage between the two were undeliverable?
Well, I could – a couple of things. One, we're not going to go by population of Anchorage, right? We're going to go by registered voters.
Right.
And so if we look at registered voters, we have – it would be about 19.6%, so about 20%.
That's a pretty significant percentage.
You know, I'll tell you, Representative Ledoux, through the chair, I think the voter registration database and the number of undeliverables was one of the interesting things that we discovered about the vote-by-mail election that we weren't expecting to find. The municipality sent out 208,000 postcards on January 3rd to notify voters what address was in the voter registration database. And we did get some responses from voters, but certainly we didn't get as many as we should have. So I think that the municipality is working with the State of Alaska Division of Elections, and we know that we have some work to do to educate voters and others about the importance of maintaining correct data in the state's database. Like when people move, we need to make sure that their address gets updated. And I think people are starting to understand that, and we do have some really good data going forward for Anchorage voters.
So I assume, since I wasn't there in Anchorage while all this was going on, that you must have advertised on TV and Facebook and radio and so forth about this by mail election to give the people who were registered voters the opportunity to know that if they didn't get a ballot, they better call the Anchorage municipality and find out what was going on. And maybe what was going on was that the municipality didn't have their correct address. Was there a lot of advertising of this?
Yes, there was, Ms. Ledoux.
Thank you.
Other questions from the committee? Rep. Wool, Rep. Birch. All right. Well, thank you very much, Ms. Jones, for the update and overview. Yeah, fascinating to see. And that's a good segue to Ms. Banky, Division of Elections Director. And I see Mr. Wilson in the audience as well. And we have what I think is a relatively short PowerPoint. Please go ahead, put yourselves on the record, and make your presentation.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Josie Banky, and I'm the director of the Division of Elections.
And my name is Brian Jackson. I'm the program manager for the division.
And my apologies, I'm mixing up my Brian Wilson and Brian Jackson. I've just been communicating with somebody else. Nice to see you.
Great. Well, thank you so much for the opportunity to come before the committee today and bring awareness to the activities of the Election Policy Work Group. We have a short presentation, and after, be happy to answer questions. So in 2015, Lieutenant Governor Malott put a small working group together to discuss election policy issues, and in 2017 expanded that group to continue a dialogue on making Alaska's election system as cost-efficient and accessible and responsive to Alaskan voters. And so in advance, following the 2016 election, our division authored this report. It was included in your packet. I'm not sure if you had a chance to look at it, but that really covered a number of issues that the division's facing, both fiscal and policy issues. And so really the report is divided into three sections: technology, elections administration, and potential cost-saving measures. So in its effort to address the issues in the report and advance those discussions, the Election Policy Work Group held five meetings. They've had five meetings from May of 2017, and their last meeting was January, and they will meet again May 9th in Anchorage. These discussions, we enlisted the help of David Becker with the Center for Innovation and Election Innovation and Research to kind of facilitate those discussions. And as you can see, the composition of the group includes the Lieutenant Governor, of course, former Lieutenant Governors Fran Ulmer, Mead Treadwell, Craig Campbell. Also includes two legislators from both bodies, you, Mr. Chairman, and appreciate the contributions you've made, and also Senator Stevens on the Senate side, along with several borough city clerks from Ketchikan, Juneau, Kenai Peninsula Borough, Barb Jones with the MOA, Fairbanks, Bethel. So it's quite a group, other advocacy groups. And actually, the group has grown as we've gone along. So we've tried to be as inclusive as possible, and I think we're up to about 30 members right now. So during their first meeting, the group by consensus agreed that the replacement of the state's 20-year-old voting system was the top priority and the most critical issue to address. And so during their first meeting, they came up with these guiding principles. The first one, maximizing accessibility, they came up with the mantra, if it doesn't work in rural Alaska, it won't work for Alaska. So, you know, the fact that elections need to be accessible, regardless of where they live, was very important. Cost effectiveness, obviously during, state budgetary constraints, looking at a system that would help contain costs, and voter satisfaction and confidence, the thought that participating in elections should be a satisfying experience for voters, and that their satisfaction with and confidence in the process is key. Longevity in the solution. Our existing system has lasted 20 years, and any new system or solution adopted must endure the test of time. Also, a big piece was coordination and buy-in, that the division work with local governments, tribes, and other stakeholders, and that nobody should be left out of the consensus-oriented decision-making process. Security and integrity. You know, any new system must be designed with security integrity in mind. Our existing system has been recognized as one of the most secure systems in the United States because we're paper-based and we're fully integrated and certified. And so it's been a good system. It's just 20 years old and time to replace. And then the last one being voter outreach. You know, that voters need to know how to interact with the election system, and our outreach efforts need to be tailored to get them the information they need effectively and efficiently. So those are the guiding principles of the group. And some of that comes up later. So how did we get to what else were we looking at aside from many other issues? But in addition to establishing these guiding principles, the group also looked at voting trends. So just to give you an idea for 2016 general, our turnout was about 60.77%. It's pretty high. We had 321,271 ballots cast. And this election also generated a record number of voters who voted early, absentee, or question ballots. Over 123,000 of those, which was compared to 2014, about 90,000. So approximately 32% of Alaskans voted via an alternative method in 2016. A record number voted early, around 40,000. And so in response to that, for 2018, we've expanded our early voting centers around the state. I think I can get you that number, but that's something we're working on for 2018. Alaskans really like to vote early. And kind of another factor at play, of course, is the Election Policy Work Group acknowledging that the MOA was having their first vote by mail election, that 40% of Alaskan voters live in the municipality. And so we've been watching very closely, working very closely with MOA, as Barb mentioned, and we'll continue to do so.
And might pause right there, Representative Tucker, question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when you say there is 12% early voting, does that include in-person absentee voting considered early voting, or is that part of your absentee voting? So someone that walks into a rural Alaska voting location and has to do an in-person absentee voting when they want to vote early, how does that count it?
Right, through the chair, Representative Tuck, that is included in the number.
In which number, the absentee or in the early voting?
Absentee and early, or excuse me, all early voting. So folks that voted 2 weeks before the election are included in that number, whether they were voting at the university or out in Tuntutuliak at the absentee voting center.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The 1% touchscreen, I'm not familiar with that. You mentioned that our system's secure, we have a paper trail, et cetera, et cetera. But obviously some people are voting on a screen, so where is that?
Right. So under the Help America Vote Act, the state was required to use these direct recording devices for those folks with either language assistance needs or so the audios on those, and then also for other folks with disabilities. And so for federal elections, we're required to have those in each polling place. And they do produce a paper record.
Thank you.
Yeah. Please proceed.
Okay. Good stuff. So really, the group started to narrow in on three different scenarios for Alaska and has discussed these at length. In scenario number one would be just to keep the same. So to keep the same paper ballot precinct-based system. on election day, 441 precinct polling places around the state. This would not require statutory or procedural changes. It would just require new equipment. And under that scenario, absentee and early voting would still be available. For a discussion quote with our current vendor, last year reached out and we looked at the cost of replacing a precinct-based system. And that was outright purchase for about $6.7 million and an annual license and warranty fee for $481,000 a year.
And I'm going to interrupt again. Representative Ledoux had a question. I'm not sure about this slide, but something in general.
So if somebody is out in an area in which there's no polling place, because I don't think all villages, and I could be wrong here, necessarily have polling places. Do right now you send people ballots, or do they have to request their absentee ballots?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, that's a good question. There is a designation of a permanent absentee voter. In which case, for example, like Squetna, I think that's a community that's all permanent absentee voter that are automatically sent their ballot in the mail. For absentee in person, voters in an even number year can sign up to receive their ballot on January 1st of the election year, but they have to apply for it. So there's a difference.
So can anybody become a permanent absentee voter?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I'm not sure. I'd have to get back to you on that.
If I may, Mr. Chair.
Sure, Representative Tuck.
No, and that's the reason why we had a bill here, House Bill 1, was allow people to, once they register to vote by mail, they can just check off a box and then continue to vote by mail. But right now, there isn't a method to do that.
You mentioned this permanent absentee status. So what I'm kind of gathering is there must be some sort of criteria in order to get this permanent absentee status, like you're living outside of an area where there's a polling place or something of that nature?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I believe it's something somebody applies for and the division evaluates it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And I've got a question on that same subject, similar to Squetna. For instance, there's a precinct in my district, Northern Prince of Wales, which is composed of a bunch of very small communities, Whale Pass, Edna Bay, Kaufman Cove, Port Protection, on and on. None of them, to my knowledge, actually have precincts on election day. So is it I realize you might not be familiar with the precinct itself, but is that the kind of precinct that is composed entirely of permanent absentee voters?
Through the chair, or Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
One more question, kind of following up.
Yes, Representative Ledoux.
So Anchorage had such great voter turnout with this voting by mail. I'm just wondering, in those areas where they have permanent absentee voting, the areas that the chair referred to, like Kaufman Cove, et cetera, whether the voter turnout in those places is higher than similarly situated places which have a polling place, and so there aren't permanent absentees.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, currently the division does conduct some of its rural education attendance areas all by mail. Some of those, for example, Whale Pass Incorporation, when they incorporated in 2017, that was conducted all by mail. So we do have instances, liquor option, those are done by mail. So we would have to go back and look at those turnouts, but I think in my next slide, I kind of get to that in other jurisdictions.
And not to preempt your next slide, Ms. Pinky, I was just going to add on to Representative Ledoux's question. I mean, I think that's a compelling question. And noted that there are REAA elections that happen by mail, but looking specifically at, say, general election or primary election turnout, where you can compare it sort of apples to apples with primary or general election, traditional precinct, precinct-based in-person voting systems, if there's a way to sort of compare turnout rates for, say, with all the permanent absentee ballot precincts in Alaska with the overall non- like regular precinct-based in-person precincts, if that makes sense. Anyway, we can circle back to this later. I can clarify that question, but wanted to flag it that I think that's a good question to answer.
Well, I will say, Mr. Chair, that the division currently, state law allows for many forms of convenience voting for Alaskans, and so I think that's probably contributes to the high voter turnout, but you're asking specifically about by mail versus precinct-based. So the second scenario that the Election Policy Work Group has looked at is to do all by mail, where every Alaskan voter would receive a ballot and have about 2 to 3 weeks to complete and mail back. Currently, three states, Oregon, Washington, and Colorado, use vote by mail exclusively. And another 22 states allow certain but not all elections to be conducted entirely by mail, including Alaska. But as I mentioned, we do conduct some of our REAA elections as well as special elections. Even though we haven't conducted a full cost analysis under this scenario, the division looking at other states would anticipate that this would result in a cost savings. Clearly, just looking at the outright purchase of a vote-by-mail system and, for $2.1 million and 181 annual license warranty fee, that is something that that we see, a trend that we saw in other states as well. So, for instance, mailing a ballot package to every registered voter is less expensive than paying for election workers, which we have about 2,500 on election day, election worker training, and polling place rental in the 441 precincts. And also, vote by mail would eliminate the type of human error that's inherent in polling place voting. And could also increase voter convenience, like we've seen in Anchorage and heard from some of those voters. So things like polling place supplies, equipment, would certainly see a cost savings. We've kind of looked and considered what those savings would be. Just storing equipment is a huge, would be a huge cost savings. But I think what the group had looked at, though, was just giving unique consideration to the rural mail service and the concern that, an all-mail ballot delivery system may be unacceptable just due to the challenges that some of our rural communities have and might experience. And also, as you know, Mr. Chair, that the state is required to provide language assistance under Section 203 of the Voting Rights Act. So definitely a consideration that we looked at in an all-by-mail system. So that's it.
I have a question.
Representative Bull.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you just brought something up about voter assistance. So you mentioned communities that do largely absentee voting because there's not a polling place. So that'd be an exception. So most every place that has a polling place has someone that can assist with language. And also perhaps even these touch screens, it sounds like those are required by law to be available at every polling place as well. And I'm just reading here, it's not that someone can't be helped to get through the process without the touchscreen, but if someone wants to vote entirely independently without someone reading to them or in some way assisting, that seemed to be what I gathered from this. But so if entirely vote by mail would sort of violate the requirement of having someone there to assist, I'm assuming you fulfill that requirement now in every village in the entire state, there's a polling place and someone to assist. Is that what I'm getting?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, our election workers are trained to provide assistance to voters with disabilities and also with language needs in those communities that are required to do so, that fall under the Section 203 of the Voting Rights Act. So we've had two lawsuits settled in the past 10 years that have designated those communities. So in those communities, we do have bilingual outreach workers in those communities on election day in the polling place.
Thank you.
How many communities are there on that list as designated by those lawsuits? Or order of magnitude?
Mr. Chair, that number under TWCUG is probably about 25, close to 40.
Okay.
But we also translate materials in Spanish, Tagalog, for those areas of the state that require us to do so. So we translate the official election pamphlet in all those languages. Under the TWCUG settlement, we translate all election materials in six dialects of Yupik, in addition to Gwich'in, and now we have new requirements that Aleutic and Aleut have both been added to the. We have communities that have that new requirement. Yeah.
Representative Tuck.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. So when you mentioned polling place errors, what kind of errors happen at the polling places?
Through the chair, Representative Tuck, for example, in the House District 40 lawsuit, where the instance where the election worker provided two ballots to voters, that's a good example of a human error.
And if I may, Mr. Chair. When you said that voting by mail will eliminate a lot of the precinct polling errors, it made it sound like that besides HD 40, there might be other errors that are happening. Is there any more you can share? What other errors are happening? Or is it just that one incident they're referring to?
Through the chair, Representative Tuck, that's just one that came to mind. Just the... you know, the process of sending out the ballot and it returning, you know, there's really no chance for human error in that, under that scenario.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. But if I may, I think one of the things that people are concerned about voting by mail is the integrity of the voting system. And so I understand if there's precinct errors that you want to eliminate that as much as possible so people know that their vote is counting properly. And but I know the process of signing your name in, showing ID, going in, grabbing your ballot, going in the booth, and then dropping your ballot into a ballot box seems pretty secure. When it comes to voting by mail, I know that when we heard from the testimony previously from the municipal election that they were looking at some signatures that couldn't be validated. So that came down to about 100. Out of 79,000 casted. So I'm looking at that number, trying to think of, well, if we're reducing the number of precinct polling errors down to this level, it makes me wonder, well, how much precinct polling errors are we having? I know we had a situation in House District 40, but so other than that, is it safe to say that we really don't have a whole lot of polling errors?
Through the chair, Representative Tuck. I would say so. Our election workers work really hard to, you know, protect the integrity and security of the election, and our results are verified by, you know, they're audited following the election, and we've never been more than 1% off.
Okay.
Our results.
I was just going off your statement. You said that it would reduce polling errors, and so I was just trying
human
to figure
errors.
Out.
Human yeah. errors. Human errors.
So okay.
Thank you. Please proceed. Hold on, Representative Ledoux's got a question.
So you were saying you've never experienced more than a 1% polling error?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, no. Following an election, our state review board comes in to audit our election results.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if you want to kind of explain that process.
For the record, my name is Brian Jackson. I'm program manager for the Division of Elections. Following the election, all of the election materials are sent here to Juneau into the director's office where they are stored until the state review board comes to review the materials. We have two different boards that review the materials. We have a hand count and verification team where that team one precinct is randomly selected out of each house district to be hand counted. And so they literally take all of the ballots and they count all of the votes for that precinct, and they match it off of the electronically generated results in our system. And through that match, we have not been more than 1% off in variance between the hand count and the electronically generated results.
But that actually seems, in elections which, you know, are won or lost with a coin toss or by, you know, very few votes, to have it even as high as 1% seems fairly substantial.
Maybe let me just make a quick comment and feel free to follow. When I was first elected, my election was recounted because it was close. And I remember researching a lot of recounted elections, and the tabulation always changes. I mean, some votes are, I don't know how or why, but I mean, between the first time the votes are counted and the second time the votes are counted, it's always a different number. Usually it doesn't range that much. For me, it was only two vote difference ultimately. But I was just going to say that I'm never greater than 1% variance in, you know, 40 precincts per election cycle that are hand counted over many years. And I realize I'm undercutting your question, Representative Ledoux, but if the sample size is really, really large, I mean, that going to say.
No, this isn't necessarily meant to be a criticism of the division, but I mean, when people are winning or losing elections by, you know, 5, 10, 0 votes, and it can actually go to a 1% difference, I guess, and that's probably all over the country, I would assume. I mean, what can be done about that? Because that actually seems fairly significant to me.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I wouldn't get stuck on the 1%. The 1% meaning the difference between the paper ballots and our electronic ballots. When we do a recount in close races, the difference between the numbers can mean, we haven't received election material from a community. Secondly, it can also mean that there were undervoted or overvoted ballots and the optical scan machine did not read the ballot. So during a recount, when those are put through the machines, if they're not reading them, the director makes a call on whether, you know, there's voter intent and they're tallied that way. So I don't know if that makes sense, but wouldn't so much, you know, the 1% is just that difference, not actually.
What I heard you say is never more than 1%, and maybe this is a stick that would be helpful for me and maybe Representative Ledoux, is what is the median variance? I mean, so it's never exceeded 1%, great, but what is, like, 9 times out of 10, what does that variance look like? Is it 0.1%? Is it 0.01%? Do you happen to know offhand? It might be interesting for the committee to know that number if it's easy to track down.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, our current system is very accurate.
Thank you.
So the third option that we've been exploring and have spent quite a bit of time exploring is. Under this system, this modern hybrid voting system, or sometimes called universal ballot delivery system, all voters would receive a ballot in the mail but have options for returning it. So they could mail it in, drop it off at a local vote center that is open maybe 1 to 2 weeks before an election day. You can also vote in person at the vote center, which offers help to voters who need it. Vote centers would provide language assistance, any sort of assistance to those that would need it. Also, if a voter fails to receive a ballot or loses it, they can obtain a new one and cast it at any vote center before or on election day. So really the election policy work group took a deep dive into this ballot delivery system, the hybrid system. The state of Colorado and Denver County have experienced many benefits since switching to this new hybrid system. Cost savings, increased voter satisfaction, decreased labor requirements and training. And as a result of that fact-finding trip, the policy work group determined that once tailored to Alaska's unique voting challenges, that this could be a viable option to deliver better results for Alaskans at a reduced cost. So they determined we needed some further research and to kind of gauge the viability of this particular system, including rural Alaska. So discussion with a group, I think it was their meeting in July, last July, took a good look at this type of system. We talked about the funding of what it would look like, what are the trends that might work for Alaska, and so that is the modern hybrid system. I think Barbara had mentioned that they had 7 vote centers within the community, within the municipality of Anchorage.
Five.
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 Thanks.
Ballot boxes.
Yeah.
And quick question from Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Tuck wants a question too, I think. I guess just a comment, not really a question, but on the hybrid system, I mean, as a society, we're going more paperless all the time, and you pay your bills online, and your bank statements are online, et cetera, et cetera. So a lot of times paper mail, in my experience, can be misplaced and maybe not mailed back. And I mean, I like the option of a person, and I have relatives in Oregon where there is no in-person voting at all. And my niece actually misses the activity of going to a ballot box, ballot booth. But so I guess my comment is that I like the hybrid, and that if you lost your ballot, or, and I'm assuming if you lose your ballot or you're out and about and your ballot's in a pile of mail at home, or your kid moved it or your dog sat on it or something, then you could just go without any, just your ID, and be able to still vote. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I might also, I guess under this current system and the one before it, mention that statutory and procedural changes would need to be considered and meaning our Title 15 of Alaska statutes would need a major overhaul and reform. So just wanted to point that out to this body in particular. And then the cost for the system, you know, $2.1 million, the same as the by mail, and then plus the cost of vote centers.
To comment on Representative Wohl's comment, it seemed, well, 14.8% of Anchorage voters, at least as I understand Ms. Jones's memo, elected to do what Representative Wohl was suggesting, although I wanted a further note. I'm not sure you're suggesting this, but having a paper trail of ballots seems, at least from my perspective, vital in any situation or any approach to voting. I know you're talking about paperless, and I'm not sure you're suggesting going paperless, but in a certain sense, we're kind of doing this parabola where, there was a lot of excitement about, I think, touchscreen voting for a while, but which Alaska has never really gotten caught up in, to my understanding. But now more than ever, the gold standard for election security is you have a paper trail for every single ballot, and you never deviate from that.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. And I don't see Alaska moving away from a paper ballot system. In fact, several states that have moved away from it are moving back to the paper-based system. Yeah.
Representative Wohl?
Tuck?
Representative Tuck.
The same. And that's actually a compliment. Thank you very much. I noticed that you mentioned that Colorado was one of the ones that do all by mail voting. Did they change to a hybrid system recently, or how is it that are they classified as different sections? I'm just curious on because you had my notes say that Oregon, Washington, and Colorado do all by mail voting.
Through the chair, Representative Tuck, I think I said exclusively all by mail. Meaning, you know, Alaska does some like the REAA elections and special elections by mail. Colorado does all theirs by mail. But yes, you're correct. They do have a hybrid piece to it.
Okay, and if I may clarify, just so I understand. So what makes them an all vote by mail and a hybrid is that they mail out to everybody, kind of like what the municipality of Anchorage did just recently, but how they return it.
Right.
Makes it the hybrid. Okay. All right. Thank you so much.
And I have a clarifying question as well. In that sense, would the Muni be considered a hybrid system given that they have accessible vote centers in which ballots can be returned in person?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to follow up on Chairman's question, they can go to these vote centers, but if they don't have a ballot, they lost it, they moved, they can still just vote with an ID, correct?
Correct, through the chair. So if somebody loses their ballot, a vote center would serve three purposes. A vote center would provide a way for somebody to receive a ballot and vote. Secondly, to drop off their ballot if they had already voted it. And third, to provide language assistance or any special assistance that voters might need in the voting process. So kind of three things. It would more or less serve as a drop box in a community. I guess it could be kind of considered the same thing. I'm thinking of smaller communities like Chivac or Hooper Bay, you know, maybe having a vote center at a tribal hall as opposed to a big concrete ballot box.
Right. Okay, thank you. And there's a section here on online vote ballot delivery services, which sounds like you can print out the ballot from an online or even fill it out online and then print it out. But also says you can email it or electronically deliver it back where it will be printed out at another location and entered as a paper ballot. But that's something you don't really – I know there would be a paper trail, but to the person voting, they would never see any paper. And I'm assuming you don't really want to head in that direction. I mean, you offer it as online ballot delivery system, and you can have the option of electronically returning the ballot to the ether, and someone in another location prints it out. But I'm assuming that you don't think that's very secure, correct?
Correct. Through the chair, Representative Wohl. This was an issue that we discussed with the election policy work group, and a lot of concerns just due to the cyber threats kind of internationally. The division has suspended the online return of ballots for 2018. We will provide voters who request it. We will provide them online to download, but they have to print it off and either mail it back or fax it back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for indulging me on this. But I guess that sort of gets back to my mail question, as obviously I have the challenge sometimes, or I have multiple P.O. boxes. I get mail in my house. You pick up mail along the way. You throw it in your car. Anyhow, the paper trail of mail can be complicated. But the online printing option I like, in that you can just go to your computer, print it out right away, you know where it is, you fill it out and put a stamp on it, and it can be returned. So that's sort of a hybrid system in and of itself. So.
And I was going to know, I hadn't realized that the email delivery had been suspended for the 2018 election, and I read it at an election security report card, which I'm sure the division has pored over, in which Alaska was given a B, which, if I recall, was the best grade in the nation, tied with several other states that also received Bs. But one of the knocks on Alaska's election security was the email delivery, and hearing that the division has responded to that is heartening and commendable. Thank you.
So, steps forward. The election policy work group's next meeting is on May 9th in Anchorage, and we'll be reporting back on some of these projects that we have in progress. The first one is we partnered with the university's Institute of Social and Economic Research to conduct a survey on behalf of the division to registered voters in the Kuzlovac, Bethel, and Dillingham census areas. And the survey asked voters to weigh in on alternative voting methods and their perceptions of mail service and any barriers that they perceive in voting. And so our sampling size, our target for the survey is 400 completed surveys. The methodology behind that I won't get into, but as of yesterday, we had 385 of those completed. So this work is ongoing, and those findings will be released by the end of May. To complement the survey, the division hosted focus groups in Bethel last week with elders and youth. Our division's UPIC interpreter held some group-style meetings with questions aimed at kind of getting the same information and facilitating those discussions with elders and youth. And, of course, not surprising that the youth in Bethel all wanted to vote online. they supported that. But looking at the pros and cons and concerns around the current voting methods and also the three proposals that we shared with you, including the hybrid system being considered. So for our next meeting, the division has invited all of the federally certified vendors. There's four of them, ClearVote, Dominion, ESNS, and Heart Civic, and asking them to conduct demonstrations on both a precinct paper ballot system, an all vote by mail system, and then the hybrid system. So I brought a schedule of the vendor, the technology fair that we're having, and would just open that up to all of you and your staff if you're available to attend those demonstrations and the election policy work group meeting if you're interested, if you're not still here. you're welcome and encouraged to attend. So that's really a way for us to look and see if there is a precinct-based system that would even work for Alaska. We know what the cost would be, but shipping, our 20-year-old system, we had to have cases, made specially for shipping those. And so, see what they have and see if there isn't, you know, a good alternative for the state.
I've got one last question. I noted in the Senate capital budget there's a line item added for replacing election equipment, and was that line item inserted in consultation with the division, and is there any vision behind how those funds will be expended?
Sure. Thanks, Mr. Chair. Actually, you preempted my
slide. Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Stealing your thunder.
Yes, we were very aware. Okay. So, just recognizing we need to replace a system, you know, we hope or expect the policy work group to eventually make an advisory recommendation to the lieutenant governor in the upcoming months. And once that decision is made, or the division gets direction on that, we'll need to conduct a full cost analysis of the recommended voting system, identify the necessary changes for Alaska Statute Title 15, and also to draft legislation. Those are some of the items that we would need to, similar to what the MOA did, was you know, hire a project manager to kind of see through the process. But we'll also need to continue working with this body, with the entire legislature and municipalities and community leaders, other stakeholder groups, to ensure that you know, that we have their support and buy-in. And so really, I think Barbara mentioned this was a big success for them in their outreach program. And so really, you know, thinking of taking something from their playbook and seeing how they've been so inclusive with that process, I think is a good example for us to follow. So community outreach definitely is going to be a big issue. So voters have knowledge and understand the any changes, if there are, to Alaska's voting system. Lastly, we will also need to go through a formal procurement process. Presently, we have secured approximately $5 million to put toward a replacement. In March of this year, the division received $3 million in Help America Vote Act funding as a part of the omnibus appropriations bill. And the remaining $2 million is a combination of existing HAVA funds. As you mentioned, Mr. Chair, in the capital budget, that was a reappropriation of lapsing funds from the governor's office. So those lapsing funds have been redirected towards us. I think that's the number you maybe saw. And then also our 5% match to that $3 million, which is $150,000. So all in all, we have about $5 million to put towards a new system. But I think above all, you know, realizing, you know, we as a division are ramping up for this year's election, and so we certainly don't want to lose momentum throughout the election cycle. And just want to make the comment that, you know, as evidenced with the MOA, that any change in the election system is going to take a lot of discussion up front and a lot of time. And so, you know, I think one thing that stuck with me at our first meeting in Anchorage here last year is one of the members said, you know, and maybe it was you, I don't remember who it was, but, and I'll just end with this quote, was that this is about making government work, and voting is a fundamental right. Cost effectiveness and other related concerns are critical, but well-run elections are of paramount importance. So with that, I'd take any questions.
Thank you. I know we've been peppering you as we've gone. Any further questions from the committee?
Just
Rep. Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. I'm glad to see the Division of Elections go in this direction. I hope you give this presentation to the Senate at some time, because I think House Bill 1 does get us in that direction as well. And I think that that first slide with the pie chart that showed early voting versus absentee, the reason I wanted to ask that question is because that's really where people get all tripped up a little bit on really what early voting is. And so I think that's one of the issues that may happen in rural Alaska, at least this is the report that I got in 2014 when we had to get out the native vote, was many people who tried to early vote were denied the opportunity to early vote because they said, well, no, you have to be absent to vote because it's an in-person absentee application. And people were being confused by that. And so I think just calling all early voting is the easiest way to handle that. That way your poll watchers and your poll workers understand as well. And so I know a lot of that comes with training, but with all these terminologies that really, should we just call it this? How it's handled is differently, but I don't think the public really needs to know that as much as they know need to know that they can early vote and they don't have to go to an early voting center to do that. And so yeah, thank you very much for the direction you're going.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wanted to point out, too, that all of this information, the report and work of the Election Policy Work Group is on our website, on our front page. And if you or your staff have any follow-up questions, happy to work with you. And also share with you, I know I only had a little bit of time today, but a lot of the technology accomplishments that we as a division have made in the past couple years. And so if you're interested in that, we're happy to share that information too.
Thank you. And we also have HB 408 on the agenda today, and I'm looking to adjourn by 4:45, so I want to move quickly on this. And I should note substantially similar policy as is contained in HB 408 was considered in the Judiciary Committee in a bill that's headed to the floor, so there's some maybe broader relevance to this legislation beyond just the standalone bill. It's a Judiciary Committee bill, a committee on which Representative Ledoux sits. Representative Ledoux, please put yourself on the record, make a brief presentation of the legislation, and we can go to our invited testimony.
Thank you. My name is Gabrielle Ledoux, and I represent House District Number 15, which consists of Muldoon and the Elmendorf portion of J-Bear. I want to thank you, Chair Christ-Thompson, and Tompkins and members of the committee for hearing this bill today. The impetus for HB 408 was brought forth by a constituent of mine. He's on the line and he's going to be testifying about his own personal experience. But mind you, while this affects this particular constituent, it affects many other people in this state also. In Alaska, a person who has had their driver's license permanently revoked due to alcohol-related offenses can apply to have their driver's license restored if 10 years have passed since the revocation and they have not been convicted of a driving-related criminal offense in that time. However, if someone was convicted of any driving-related crime, such as driving without a license, any time after the date of revocation, it appears that except for one limited circumstance, their driver's license may never be restored under current law. And that limited exception is if you've been convicted, if you've the three strikes are out, and so you can't have your driver's license anymore. But you then go and have another DUI. And so you get sent to a therapeutic court. If you've gone through the therapeutic court experience, then you can apply for at least a limited license. So somebody who stayed totally clean, like for 10 or 15 years, and has not gotten caught driving while intoxicated again, because maybe they are not either drinking or they're not violating any law, has absolutely no way right now to get their driver's license. But if you totally ignore the law and go out and get yourself a DUI again, then you can get sent to a therapeutic court and have the opportunity to get your driver's license back. And that inconsistency doesn't make any sense to me. And so that was the impetus behind House Bill 408. And my aide, Greg Smith, can elaborate a little bit here, and he can answer any questions that you might have, and then hopefully we'll be able to get to Mr. Hooper, who is on the line waiting to testify about his experience in trying to get his driver's license back.
Thank you. And in terms of questions, I'll maybe go around the table and people can ask a series of questions if they choose. I should also note that Michael Stanker with the Department of Law and Marla Thompson with the Division of Motor Vehicles are both online and available. Questions on HB 408? And Nancy Mead with the court system is in the room as well. Representative Wohl, looks like you've got something to say.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I need some clarification, and maybe Greg can help me out. So if I get a DUI and I lose my license, and I've known this to happen to people that instead of trying to get their license back with SR-22, and they just say, forget it, I'm not driving. Would this, if they take 10 years off from driving, and assuming they had no other driving crime, which would also include driving without a license, because that, if you don't have a license because you had a DUI and you take 10 years off, but you can't help yourself and you drive, that would disqualify you from this 10-year period. That's, I guess, part A. And part B, if you just didn't do anything for 10 years and then just tried to get your license back, I would imagine, still have to go through the alcohol thing in the car and the SR-22 and all the other stuff that people that want to drive after DUI have to do.
Greg Smith, staff to Representative Ledoux. Through the chair, Representative Wohl. This bill is trying to deal with people that had their license permanently revoked due to, in this case, felony DUIs, and that's three, I believe, within a 10-year period. Okay. Then if they committed any driving-related criminal offense after that revocation, our understanding is that there is no remedy for them in which to get their license back. Unsure about the not driving or not getting their license or the insurance part. Does that help?
Yeah, follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So basically this is for the permanent revocation, felony DUI, which is multiple DUIs. They lose their license. What this bill would do is say if they're clean for 10 years, absolutely, and that includes the charge of driving without a license, because that's what I would guess most people that have license revocation end up continue driving, which they just can't not drive. So if they don't drive for 10 years and have no driving, which I guess to have no criminally, what's it called? No criminal offense, driving-related criminal offense, that would be anything in a car that's moving, because if they got their driver's license revoked, then even driving is a criminal offense. So as long as they don't drive or certainly not get a speeding ticket, et cetera, then they could apply, they could get their license back after 10 years.
Representative Wohl, through the chair, yes, that's my understanding. I think the situation that we're kind of encountering is people at whatever stage in their life, but maybe say someone young has problems and potentially multiple problems of driving while intoxicated, which is we've obviously shown to be a major issue in the state and something that we're very concerned with. This bill is to try to look at people who have since reformed had issues when they're young, had their license permanently revoked, then had any driving-related criminal offense, again, at whatever age, and then at which point they are under current law, they can never then get a license again, even if it's been 20, 30 years and they've come clean and reformed and those type of things.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wohl. Going around, Representative Tuck?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if I read the one-line change to the bill, So if somebody were to have a felony DWI and in year nine gets caught driving, that means he would wait another 10 years before he would be able to get a driver's license, but he'd still be able to get one. Is that correct? Okay.
Representative Tuck, through the chair, yes, that's the intent of the bill is that, and our read on is that they would need to have 10 years essentially of
clean.
Of a clean, of no driving related criminal offenses before they can then petition, I believe is the right term, to get their license restored.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Seeing no further questions, going to move to invited testimony. Sean Hooper in Anchorage has invited testimony, and we'll give you 3 minutes, and of course, questions after, as the committee may have. Mr. Hooper, thanks for joining us. Please put yourself on the record and present your invited testimony.
My name is Sean Hooper. Back in 2002, I got a felony DWI and went through treatment and everything. And then in 2003, I got in trouble for riding a motorcycle without a license. And since then, it's been almost 15 years. You know, I've straightened my life out, got my life together, and I've tried to get my driver's license back a few times. And because of the way the law is written now, because of my, if there's any criminal offense after your felony DWI, you can't apply for a limited license or anything. And so that's why I called Gabrielle Ledoux and talked to her, you know, because there's no options for me because of that one criminal offense. And so I just, you know, I appreciate you guys looking at this. I mean, I don't know what else to do besides to try and change the law, you know, to where there's a possibility, you know, that I've reformed and can do move forward with my life. That's basically all I've got to say, I guess. I'm kind of nervous.
Thank you, Mr. Hooper. Any questions from the committee?
I just want to thank Mr. Hooper for testifying and bringing forth to me this problem, which not only affects him, but affects many others.
Question. Representative Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hooper, just to clarify, you had your license revoked for a felony DUI. Is that because it was your third or some number like that?
Yeah, it was my third. I got the third DWI right after they changed the law to where it was 3 in 10 years or 3 in 5 years. And, you know, I was an idiot. I was young, stupid, invincible, and that's why I got, you know, 3 DWIs when I was in my early 20s.
Rep. Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Hooper, you then had a moving violation on a motorcycle, I guess, simply because you were driving it and you didn't have a license. Did that trigger something else, or that was just another violation? I mean, you'd already lost your license permanently from the felony DUI, or is that just for 10 years?
I lost it permanently for the felony DWI. But the way the law was written that after 10 years that you're off of felony or off of probation and supervised probation, you can apply for termination of revocation. So that you can, you know, you show you've cleaned up, you can, you know, for 10 years you could get your license back, unless you've had any criminal offense after the felony DWI, which was my criminal offense after the felony DWI was driving with the wild license revoked in 2003.
Follow up? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, it sounds like this isn't necessarily a question for Mr. Hooper, but what he's describing is that he could have applied for the ending of the revocation after 10 years if he hadn't had the moving violation on the motorcycle. So it sounds like this bill is doing just that. As long as he didn't drive the motorcycle, he could have done that, And is that current law? Was that law changed and you want to put that law back? If he says that he could have applied after 10 years, I'm just unclear.
He could have applied after 10 years as long as he didn't have any other driving-related criminal offenses. And he did because he had he was driving without a license. But he's been clean now for 15 years, and there's no way that he can get – even though he's been clean now for 15 years, he's had that one offense. And so he can never get this license.
It's a little bit like SR-22, lifetime offense.
Right. We're not going there.
So, Representative Wolf.
So just to understand the bill, what this bill would say is, in the case of Mr. Hooper, he had felony DUI, lost his license. After 10 years, he could have applied. However, he had another vehicle conviction, and therefore lost it indefinitely. This bill would say, if you wait 10 years after that moving violation,
right,
so you can lose your driver's license for 10, and then in 10 years you can get a new one, or you can get it back possibly. But at year 7, you drive and you get caught, boom. Instead of resetting the 10-year clock, it's indefinite. This would reset the 10-year clock.
Yeah, this would reset the 10-year
okay.
clock.
Thank you.
And I would comment that part of what was presented in judiciary on this concept is that right now, I mean, there may be logic in the bill just in isolation, but under current law with justice reform, now there's a pathway to someone post SB 91 who does dumb stuff, gets DUIs, but has a pathway to getting their license back. And could you speak to that pathway? Because I think understanding that juxtaposition was helpful for me.
We might ask someone from the court system or somebody from Department of Motor Vehicles about that too.
Ms. Mead, what's that? I think so, unless you have a question for Mr. Hooper. Yeah, maybe Ms. Mead, I think you were volunteered by Representative Ledoux. It's very thoughtful of her.
Someone from the court system.
And Rep. Birch, we'll have you in the queue. Ms. Mead, would you be able to speak to that pathway that presently exists?
Yes, for the record, this is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. Before SB 91, there was no way for a person with a felony DUI, because the DUI law requires permanent revocation, to get a limited driver's license. Misdemeanants could get a limited license that was good for taking them to work under certain circumstances. SB 91 added a provision saying that people with a felony DUI, so your third within 10 years, who had their license permanently revoked, could nonetheless get a limited one if they had gone through a therapeutic court program and met other requirements, such as proof of financial responsibility, which is generally the SR-22 insurance, use the ignition interlock device, and a few other things. And if an individual lives in a community where there is no therapeutic court, because we don't have them everywhere all over the state, they had to show a judge that they had gone through a treatment program with conditions that are similar to therapeutic court, 18 months long, intensive oversight, some residential, et cetera. And if a person could do that, that was an alternative to the therapeutic court. And then, having driven under this limited felony license for 3 years, they could apply under this same provision, 2835-0300, that's in the bill, section 2, to have, with 3 years of satisfactorily driving under the limited license, could get a full restoration. And that was retroactive. If somebody went through therapeutic court in 2004 and had their license revoked, they could take advantage of that.
Thank you. Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if someone were to go through the exception of the therapeutic courts and get a limited license, with the passage of this bill, would they no longer have – they can have a free open license and no longer have to have the interlock blowing device as well?
Through the chair to Representative Tuck, the ignition interlock device is a requirement for anybody convicted of DUI. The law says that you permanently lose your license, but the law also says when and if you ever drive again, you must use the ignition interlock for a set period of time. So that's in every judgment. So and that's because that's what the DUI laws say. So that avenue of the limited license that I described after therapeutic court still exists, and you can still get, after 3 years of a limited license, your license restored. And that's the existing law. You can read it on page 1 starting at line 13. But this, section 01 starting on line 4, is a different way. If you didn't go through therapeutic court, and many people do not, you can simply, after 10 years of clean driving record, apply for a full restored license, despite the fact that the revocation was permanent.
Follow up. Okay, so I'm going to repeat it back just to make sure I understand. And let me just tell you a scenario, because I do have a friend who, in a short period of time, early in his life, got three DWIs. And only recently, after probably about 15 years, I would say, maybe even longer, that he, with the passage of Senate Bill 91, was able to go and actually get a driver's license. And he has an interlock. And I don't know if he had a driving violation after that. I don't know what prevented him from being able to do that for such a long time. Maybe it'd be the same situation as Sean may have had. So he went through therapeutic courts also. So if the passage of this bill, if he has no prior violations over 10 years, then he would be able to apply for a full driver's license, which would remove him having to do the interlock and be able to have the same privileges as someone, I guess, applying for a driver's license for the first time. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Tuck, yes, but he has a better avenue to get his full driver's license, and that is after driving under a limited license, which your individual has, for 3 years under O2, you can, without a problem, without having more DUIs or more driving-related problems, so after 3 years you can get it restored. So that's a three-year avenue, which is probably more advantageous than the 10-year avenue, depending on the timing for this individual.
Sure. Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I like this. I'm a believer in redemption, and I guess, but I'm also interested in the statistics. And you know, we have a lot of issues with recidivism in the legal system. Are there any statistics out there to where, where people have a reversion issue? I mean, where people, I mean, you wait 10 years, somebody gets a license back, and it's a, I mean, do you have any statistics as to how frequently people go back and reoffend, if you will, after getting a license back? Or is it, I assume it's fairly, we're in pretty good shape, but I just, through the chair, would be interested if there's any statistics on, first of all, how many people are involved that this would, you know, is it 100 or 500 or 1,000? Or, you know, and what kind of numbers are we dealing with here?
Through the chair to Representative Birch, I thought you were going somewhere else with statistics. For the number of people who have applied under 01, first of all, that was only the 10-year you can get it back and permanent revocation. That only went into effect in 2002. So the first people who could potentially even apply for this, excuse me, would have been in 2012. And I will defer to the DMV to tell you how many applications they've received for it and how many they've then granted. As Representative Wool pointed out, a lot of individuals in this category do indeed end up with a driving with license suspended and therefore disqualify themselves. But with that, I'd defer to DMV to tell you the numbers.
Ms. Thompson, if you're online, do you happen to know the statistics Representative Birch was asking after?
Marla Thompson, DMV director. Through the chair, no, we don't have that stat available today, but we could pull that tomorrow.
Yes, if you could please provide that to my office and we'll circulate it to the committee. Mr. Smith.
Greg Smith, staff representative Ledoux. Representative Birch to the chair. I don't know if it's quite answering your precise question, but I did find some information showing that the revocation of a license is an effective mechanism to reduce recidivism. What was less conclusive was what the optimal length of a revocation. They found, I guess, in some cases that long revocation periods actually taught people that it was okay to drive without a license, and actually led to them doing so because they found that they could drive without a license and not be caught.
Follow. Yeah, I look forward to getting some of the information, because I think it's ultimately it's about public safety, and I think usually it'd be helpful to see if the statistics bear that out. So thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Ledoux.
So I'm curious about something. Could someone like Mr. Hooper, who had his DUIs back 15 years ago, could he go to therapeutic court now without being currently having a DUI?
Through the chair to Representative Ledoux, no. Therapeutic court is an alternative way to deal with a charge. So you have to have a live case. The court doesn't give social services to people who don't have a case in front of it. So if you're arrested and come before the court, the therapeutic route is an alternative to the traditional court jury route. So it isn't a program that's just generally available to public people with a problem.
So my understanding, as I said it, is correct. I mean, if somebody in Mr. Hooper's position actually went out and got a DUI while he was driving, and they sent him to therapeutic court, he could then apply for a limited license, but he doesn't want to go out and get a DUI. He'd rather just, continue on the straight and narrow. And the straight and narrow, as the law exists right now, puts him in a worse position than if he got a DUI.
Through the chair to Representative Ledoux, that is literally true, but I do want to say that therapeutic court is not a picnic. It's an 18-month intensively supervised program with social workers involved, probation officers involved, seeing the judge every couple of days at the beginning, tapering off to a week, tapering off through the 18-month minimum. So you are correct, and everyone has to agree that you're an appropriate candidate for that route because you're subject or capable of rehabilitation rather than the traditional route. So I don't mean I don't want it to be left that anyone can just go through therapeutic court. It's quite a difficult process.
I understand that, but it seems really unfair that somebody can go through therapeutic court, which may not be a picnic, and have a route to get their driver's license back, but somebody who doesn't get the DUI in the first place, after 15 years, doesn't have, any option of getting their license back.
And through the chair, Representative, that is what the law provides. And I think what happened in SB 91 is there was no way for a limited license. And this 10-year period with never having had any DWLSs in that time period doesn't help a lot of people, because many of them do have a DW, driving with their license suspended at some point. So that becomes plain unavailable. And I believe in SB 91, the thinking was, well, let's make it available to some people, but how can there be some assurance that this person won't recidivate and show some signs of rehabilitation? Well, therapeutic court is one concrete way to say that they've come through. So I'm not defending it, but that is why that law was put in, and that's what we have.
And when you were describing the therapeutic court pathway, I remember you used the word retroactive or retroactivity, and I forget exactly in reference to what, but could you describe the retroactivity associated with the therapeutic court pathway to getting your license back?
To the chair, I think what I must have referred to meant by that is that it doesn't matter. In SB 91, when it said, if you've gone through therapeutic court, here's a route for you, it was for people who had offenses before the effective date of SB 91, so that if you had your felony DUI in 2009 and went through therapeutic court in Palmer in 2009 or Fairbanks, and you haven't been driving since, you could still apply to DMV for that limited driver's license. So it applied to old offenses. It was meant to address people who were out there with no avenue, to give them something. And the therapeutic court was an assurance. I think the legislative intent would be that those folks at least have shown, if you graduated, that you're somewhat rehabilitated.
Thank you. That clarifies. Representative Wold, did you still have a question?
I guess more of a comment, but maybe a question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if someone gets a felony DUI, loses their license permanently, it sounds like under current law, pre-SB 91, after 10 years, if they had no violations, they could apply to get a license returned to them. Is that correct?
Through the chair to Representative Wold, that's correct.
Okay. Follow up. Thank you. So, and I don't know what study you mentioned, studies have shown if there's some pathway back after a period of no license. I guess at least having some option of getting a legal license back is good, because, again, if someone has lost their license and continues to drive, and if the only punishment is they lose their license, but they've already lost their license, I don't know that people are being put in jail for driving without a license. So I guess if the incentive is, well, don't drive and someday you could get a license legit, that's a good incentive. And I don't know. I guess the question is 10 years the right amount of time for that? And so it's more of a rhetorical question. But if someone has a license revoked and they drive without a license, I think you had a name for it, DWS, driving with license suspended or something, is the penalty just you're really not going to get your license back? Or is it, I imagine you generally don't go to jail for that crime?
Through the chair to Representative Wool, driving with license suspended, which I referred to as DWLS, it's actually a very common charge. And conviction. We get about 1,800 people convicted of it each year. SB 91 dealt with that crime and separated it into two different things. If your license was suspended and you get caught driving for something other than DUI or refusal, and there are other ways you can get your license suspended, namely, I mean, the main one is getting a lot of points from speeding and going through school zones, you get your license suspended. Then it's just an infraction. You get a $300 ticket. But if you drive with a license suspended, and it was suspended due to a DUI, whether that's a misdemeanor or felony DUI, it's a Class A misdemeanor. And then the statute spells out that your first time, I think I have this right, it's you will get 10 days with 10 days suspended, and the second time, 10 days. So people do go to jail for DWLS.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. And I have a question for the division. Ms. Thompson or Ms. Montalvo, and which is, does the division have a position on this piece of legislation? And Ms. Thompson, if you can hear us, please put yourself on the record and speak to the question if you can.
This is Marla Thompson, Director of the DMV, and through the chair, we don't have a position on this legislation.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee? All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Mead, Ms. Thompson. Thank you, Doug. And I think that concludes our business today. I wanted to, Representative Tuck?
Would you like to move the bill?
I try not to move legislation on a first hearing, and
well,
I think
this is day 99, 900. I would think that you know, a couple things. First thing is, I'm glad that we're reforming some of the stuff that we have, and the bill is including the SR-22 fix that we had earlier. Mm-hmm. I almost see this as an amendment more than a bill. I see this as a necessary fix that needs to happen. But if your intent is to hold it, That's fine, but this is pretty much a one-line item, one sentence, which can easily have been an amendment to another bill. But if you were interested in moving it, I'd be more than happy to.
I appreciate the enthusiasm. I'll hold it for now, but look to move it and consult with a sponsor later, as I know she's got a stratagem in mind. I think that covers things. I should note interested possibly in a hearing as we go forward on election security, given news coverage and media coverage on the subject. Just wanted to flag that for committee members, and if you have thoughts, please come to me and we can work together. But talking with some national experts and, of course, bringing the division on that subject. But I think that concludes things for now. Thank you, Doug and Martha, and at 4:58, we are adjourned.